Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchuk. On today's show, we'll hear a presentation I gave regarding problems and solutions to the recent economic situation, as well as responses to questions asked about the presentation. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Wilson, North Carolina, is a small city of 47,000, located 45 miles east of Raleigh. It grew up with the tobacco industry at the turn of the 20th century. And while tobacco remains, the boom years are in the past, and the city is looking ahead to the new information economy. Internet service for Wilson had been slow and unreliable. So in 2006, the city built a fiber optic ring that connected city facilities like City Hall, Parks and Recreation, and town offices to super-fast broadband. After requests from local businesses, the city council voted to expand the fiber network to the entire city. Brian Bowman is the public affairs manager for the city of Wilson.
We went to Time Warner and to Embark and said, we would love for you to build a fiber to the premise network in Wilson. Embark said that they wanted to work with us to partner on that. It turned out it didn't work out because we couldn't meet that middle ground for both of us for it to work out. And Time Warner just said, no, we're not going to do that right now. So we said, okay, we'll do it ourselves.
Wilson's network, called Greenlight, is up and running, with connections up to 100 megabits per second, which makes it among the fastest services available in the country. The city offers a triple play package of TV, phone, and internet for $99 per month every month. That beats Time Warner Cable's package that has fewer channels, slower upload speeds, and costs 40% more at the start. After less than a year in business, Greenlight has already signed up more than 3,000 customers, and that apparently has made Time Warner Cable, Embark, and AT&T very nervous. They've backed a new bill in the North Carolina state legislature that would ban the use of certain municipal funds to finance and maintain a broadband network and would cut off local communities from receiving money for broadband from the Federal American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
If this bill had been law when we started, Greenlight would not exist today. It simply sandbags the cities where it's not possible or practical to do it. That's the effect of the bill.
The bill's sponsors are clearly taking their marching orders from the cable and phone companies. Bowman describes a recent hearing.
You know who's in the room with you, and it is a handful of private sector providers who seem to be the ones who were talking in the hallways to the sponsors. And, you know, we saw a person from Time Warner, in fact, hand a note to one of the sponsors during the meeting, and the sponsor then spoke up. So all you know officially is who the sponsors are, but, you know, you can see what's happening in the room.
Bowman says that Wilson is one of those cities that doesn't have the population density that makes it attractive to private industry.
If profit was going to be the motive, we were going to be waiting potentially decades to get this critical service, which we believe our businesses need. And right now we're doing it ourselves. We're having good results. And this law would essentially keep other cities in North Carolina from being able to do the same thing.
And now, a special commentary about community radio by Media Minute's own Candace Clement.
Last week, more than 40 representatives from community radio stations and groups hoping to obtain broadcast licenses visited Washington, D.C. to tell their stories to Congress. In a series of visits to congressional offices, the Federal Communications Commission, and the White House, they urged action on the Local Community Radio Act, a bill that would put more low-power FM, or LPFM, radio stations on the air. Some of the visitors were from existing LPFM stations and came to D.C. to explain the wide array of benefits that local radio can bring. They included KPCNLP, an LPFM in Woodburn, Oregon, that broadcasts in four languages native to the indigenous communities of the local farm workers. Also there was WRFNLP, Radio Free Nashville, a station with nearly 100 local programmers broadcasting community news and local music, providing an antidote to the five Clear Channel stations dominating the local airwaves. Others came to talk about the radio stations their community wanted to start but can't get on the air until this legislation passes. The Chicago Independent Radio Project, or CHIRP, is pulling together everything needed to get their station on the air, right down to the drywall for its studio. And Detroit Summer, which organizes youth-led media arts projects, came to speak about the particular needs that cities face and how LPFMs can help them achieve their mission. Democratic Representative Mike Doyle of Pennsylvania, who introduced the legislation in the House with Republican Representative Lee Terry of Nebraska, stated at a policy briefing last Thursday that Rick Boucher, the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Communications Subcommittee, seemed inclined to move toward a hearing on the legislation soon, the crucial next step toward putting more LPFM stations on the air. To learn more about the Local Community Radio Act, visit PrometheusRadio.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature a presentation I gave regarding problems and solutions to the recent economic situation, as well as responses to questions asked about the presentation. The presentation was given at a panel on economics organized by the Albany Park North Park Mayfair Neighbors for Peace and Justice at the Albany Park branch of the Chicago Public Library on Saturday, April 25th, 2009. In this presentation, I'll address four questions pertaining to our economy. Question one, what are some of the problems? Question two, what solutions have been proposed? Question three, what solutions would I advocate? And question four, what can we do? The presentation that I'll give is divided into four sections, one for each of these four questions. And in keeping with the panel, we'll be focusing on the economy and economics. And if there's something here that's unclear or confusing, please let me know. Ask after the presentation, and I'll do my best to clarify. Section one, question one, what are some of the problems? The economic problems we face are unarguably systemic. Among the gravest of them are the disproportionate role that limited liability corporations with rights of personhood pose to humanity and the planet. Government regulations, one entity that might serve as a check and balance to corporate power, often are handmaidens for corporate interests and stepping stones to corporate interests. Pick any broad realm you choose: the environment, war and militarism, labor rights, energy, education, media, and a thousand others. Chances are very good that one or more corporations have a stranglehold of control and progress. Thus, a great deal of activism rightly targets corporations. Another consideration is the economic institution of markets, where buyers and sellers are pitted against one another. Corporate dominance is, to a great extent, fueled by markets, because corporations, as described in the film The Corporation, are the political economic equivalent of monsters. Corporations demand increasing profit for their shareholders at the expense of everything else. In a market economy, it is perversely rational to establish these corporate monsters, since markets are a competitive realm where you win at another's expense, to behave like a monster in effect. And the bigger the monster, the better the chance to win. Therefore, it is imperative to address markets as well as corporations. This is a cruel irony, since markets have been touted in various ways, even by many liberals and leftists, as neutral, beneficent, or unavoidable, but seldom as a key institution that should be abolished and replaced. The proverbial invisible hand of competitive markets is long touted. Far less discussed is what some critical economists have called the invisible foot, which referred to the problems that are endemic to markets. These problems include markets' competitive ethos fostering monstrous corporations, markets' chronic mispricing, prices exclusively on buyers and sellers, and markets persistently ignoring social, labor, and environmental considerations. So section two, what solutions have been proposed? Some believe that markets can be controlled and harnessed, and their worst aspects contained and minimized. But, as I've said elsewhere, provisions can be put in place to mitigate some of the negative effects of markets, just as we see in present-day efforts to oppose corporations. But corporations, by their competitive urge and competitive advantage, fight back. And thanks to this eat-or-be-eaten logic of markets, corporations win nearly every time. Plus, there remains the potential to ignore or belittle the chronic problems with markets: blatant mispricing, commodity fetishism, ignoring social consumption, and others. Some may try to solve those problems by means outside of the market, but market advocates fight back with the proverbial stick of free markets. Many on the left have proposed a command planning economy instead, even though this has been soundly rebuked, including by mainstream economists. Command planning economies bear top-down hierarchies. They ignore social effects. They see technical information monopolized by a select few. And, ironically enough, for a supposedly non-competitive model, they spawn competition among actors within the command planning pecking order. So now we see an intersection of supposedly disparate parts of the economic spectrum. Corporations themselves are command planning economies and possess the structural attributes of command planning economies. This leads to another cruel irony. Those who advocate markets as an alternative wind up spawning the very command planning institutions they've opposed, except that they're corporations originating in the economic sphere rather than command-planning states in the political sphere. So what could remain instead of these retentionist systems of markets, command-planning, and corporations? Well, since the economic problems at hand are systemic, the solutions themselves must also be systemic. And one set of alternative economic systems that has been offered is termed democratic planning. So section 3, what solution would I advocate? The best model of democratic planning goes by the name of PARECON, participatory economics, and folks in the audience have a handout that talks about it in some depth. I'll talk about it now. Here's a description of what it is, how it works, and how it's better than what's come before. PARECON is an economic model that strives to achieve solidarity, equity, efficiency, diversity, and self-management, a set of values encapsulated in the acronym SEEDS. PARECON has four main institutions. 1. All jobs are balanced for desirability and empowerment. 2. Remuneration is determined by effort and sacrifice and socially valued labor as gauged by one's workmates. 3. Economic decisions are made by decision-making bodies comprising those who work in a workplace or consume in a residence, where those who are impacted by a decision have decision-making power proportional to the degree they're impacted by that decision. And 4. A participatory planning procedure addresses allocation, where consumption or production plans are submitted with the help of a facilitation mechanism to those who are impacted by those plans, and revised if necessary by those who made those plans in a series of rounds based on assorted qualitative and quantitative feedback, all done without command planning and without markets. PARECON is better than the retentionist systems like command planning, markets, and corporations because PARECON spells out a new and markedly different set of rules to achieve a positive set of goals. Retentionist systems bear job hierarchies where a relative few have highly empowering and desirable jobs, whereas participatory economics requires jobs balanced for desirability and empowerment among all actors. Retentionist systems pay poorly and require decisions that overwhelmingly negatively affect those who have little say in those decisions. PARECON pays more fairly and strives to provide more fair decision-making power to its participants. In allocation, PARECON uses participatory planning for the shared goal of eliminating excess demand, in contrast to competitive markets, which spawn command planning corporations, and to the command planning economies, which spawn competition. Section 4, what can we do? In sum, we should abolish corporations by abolishing the markets where they spawn and thrive and replace those markets with a participatory economy. Easier said than done. How might we do that? First, we must widen awareness of the idea and build support for it. There are many things we can do, like this panel, and expressing the ideas in various creative media, radio, video and film, in print, on the internet, and elsewhere, and in various forms, fictional and actual alike. We also have to draw connections between this admittedly abstract and far-reaching proposal and the immediate impacts it has on so-called everyday people. We can use these ideas to help people in their immediate needs and concerns and connect previously disparate activist efforts on the immediate anti-corporate initiatives along with those who work on the theoretical economics front. The next steps, and the harder steps, include calling out the hypocrisy and double standards among retentionists, regardless where they fall on the political spectrum. It's easy to mock acolytes of Milton Friedman as unwitting and hypocritical command planning advocates, especially these days. It's far more difficult to critique liberal or left groups that implement organizational structures that often structurally mimic the very corporations we oppose. It's also hard, but necessary, to build new institutions that implement PARECON rules and principles. There are already some existing examples, and we should continue to build more. One other idea along these lines would be to make a website or other entity that has established a useful function directly using the structures of participatory economics to its advantage. At some point, with continued agitation and with expanded imagination, we can ultimately implement the institutional changes we need, but we must seriously take on the question, what do we want? Oddly enough, both libertarians and Marxists, even though they can't agree on what color the sky is, curiously offer the very same response to the question of, what do you want? They both often answer, let's figure that out after we win. Fat chance! We won't win if we don't seriously address the question first. And I hope that this presentation offers some food for thought in this regard. I thank you for your time and attention, and I look forward to your questions and comments after Neil gives his presentation.
Very good.
You're a racehorse.
Right. Thank you. There'll be copies of the speech if anyone wants it that I can make available online, or if you want a print copy, just see me after class.
You talked about this remuneration for effort and sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of allowance in there for people who are handicapped, who can produce less, but demand more resources?
Yeah.
Second question is, which is not in there at all. You talk about economic decisions made by bodies comprising those who work in a workplace as well as consumers. And there's, in my experience, there's an inherent contradiction that exists between people who work and those same people who go in back in their community and consume. That there's a problem because consumers want things cheaper. Workers want to get more for their labor. And how do you resolve that constant, I don't care what system it is, that constant antagonism between interests, between the same people as they are in different groups?
Yeah. Let's address the questions. Remuneration, preference, and sacrifice. You're right that, in fact, actually, it would be inhumane if, for whatever reason, let's say you were, I don't know, well, actually, I can mention an example from my own family. My great-grandfather actually emigrated to this United States and then had to immigrate to Poland, where he was originally from, because he lost an arm in an industrial accident. An industrial press lost his arm, couldn't get a job in the United States, had to go back to Poland and farm. And that's actually a reason why my grandmother was born in Poland and then immigrated back here to the United States to no small extent because of people and the guy here who everyone knows and loves, Gerald Ford. That's another story, though. In this example, just to mention this example, if you're unable to work because of some physical handicap, you would not have, and this has actually been talked about in some of the theory that's been written about participatory economics. Obviously, that would be inhumane if you couldn't work because of something that had nothing to do with you. But that, in a lot of ways, that happens now. I mean, you can find stipends from the government, not a lot, and a lot of the social welfare system had been eviscerated, I know. But there would be nothing inherent to the system to allow for that, for if you were unable to work. Here, in fact, actually, we're wasting a lot of productive effort now regarding people who could work but are not allowed to or can't find jobs. And in fact, there's actually a policy that's implemented. I think it's called the U7 rate, which actually mandates a minimum unemployment rate for the United States, which is not included with numbers of unemployment. So that the reason that's allowed is because they can actually be used with a surplus pool of labor as leveraging power against people who may want to organize for their rights for higher wages and for greater accountability on that front. So yeah, you're right. That should be included. I didn't include it in this handout because, as you can tell, there's only so much you can write in a half page. But in some of the theory about this, and when people have addressed the question, yeah, there's no incompatibility regarding this and the model. So that's solid. And the second question with regards to conflict between consumers and producers, well, actually, that's answered by part four of the handout, participatory planning. The tension that you would sometimes see regarding consumers and producers would be addressed because of the model of participatory planning. You don't use markets. That competitive realm, and I actually addressed this a little bit in my talk, assumes that you've got a competitive situation between actors, between, in this case, consumers and producers. In the participatory planning model, that's not the case. You've got a shared goal of trying to eliminate excess demand. And so that means that consumers have some set of interests, producers have their own set of interests, and remember that these won't be mutually exclusive. Anyone who is going to be consuming stuff will also be a producer. And so that there's going to be some kind of concern there about, those of us who live in and around Albany Park, Lincoln Square, Ravenswood might comprise our own consumer decision-making body. We all live here, we're going to breathe the same air, we're going to consume the same resources like a library, like the streets that we use, like the buses that we use, and so forth. At the same time, you're going to have producer institutions. They could be local businesses or the near Paricon equivalent of that. They could be maybe entire industries. They could be federations of industries who will also say, look, we've got these, they'll see that, look, these various consumer entities are producing, going to have specific consumption requests. How can we best fill them? And also do that in a way that is humane and that is a minimal impact to the environment. And that's basically, in a very crude sketch outline, the idea of the participatory planning system, that we each have our own requests of what we can try to fulfill. We each get those plans back. If they all match, fantastic. But chances are that's probably not going to happen on the first go around. So then you would make revisions based on the information they receive back of what costs more this year versus last year, or what new concerns have come up, or what new technological innovations have arrived that could help us in whatever, either producing stuff and making, reducing costs and keeping things environmentally sound. And then repeat the process until you get to that point where you do arrive at that matter of equilibrium and in an efficient manner, without having to deal with that matter of, I have to get ahead by stepping on your face, or you do likewise to me. That's not, at least as far as the theory goes, implemented here. So the answer to part three is part four.
The idea of the invisible hand. I don't know if anybody else caught that, but I don't even know if anybody even knows what that really implies. The invisible hand refers to God, refers to natural law, and back in the late 1800s, a Norwegian economist that lived mostly in Wisconsin, Thorstein Veblen, wrote an article called Why Economics is Not an Evolutionary Science. And it's because it hasn't been, scientific method hasn't been applied to economics. It's based on natural law of, I deserve this, because if I have this, I must be good by God's eyes. So you're not going to get jacked because you're a wretched peasant or whatever, And so that's more just a background historical comment of, how it is we even got to this stinking place. But I'm curious as to know what par econ, what the model does to address unions, labor unions. Growing up in a Teamster union household, yes. I saw how, it was great. It stabilized our family. My parents made more money and all that. But, here's another example of union abuse. That very good friend of mine's mother makes $22 an hour plus full benefits to drive a little truck 25 feet back and forth. That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
$22 an hour to drive a little truck back and forth to pick up something and take it over here. And that just blows me away. That's just wasteful. It's abusive. And I'm all for unions, but I'm also wanting to have some sort of levity in a situation to where these salaries aren't just egregious. Mm-hmm. Where the union boss at Northeastern makes more than the professors that he or she represents. And that's something's wrong with that. I don't get it.
The professors haven't organized. That's what's wrong with it.
They have organized. Oh, they're really active.
They're unionized in Northeast.
Oh, yeah.
My daughter works in Northeast.
Yeah.
Okay. There are two threads here. One was with regards to, I guess you can ask the question, why do we have unions now? Well, the reason they've been organized historically, and now to a great extent, is to basically allow for people who individually don't have a whole lot of power. If you bring them together, they can then have increased power to win whatever, increased wages, more rights on the job, more dignity on the job, maybe even say with regards to what the job is, and so forth. So the whole point of unions, I think, is to basically create a tool that can improve the lot of a lot of people. And it's not just within like a given company. If, say, the United Auto Workers is challenging General Motors for higher wages, I mean, that's certainly been the case. The classic example, the 1937 sit-down strike for close to 2 months, which wound up not only forming the union and also winning a lot of wages, but also set a precedent that wound up reverberating throughout the entire economy. And so that's great. And then actually, a lot of people have argued that was actually the fomenting that subsequent surge in union organizing helped to form the middle class and helped to reduce a lot of hardship for a lot of people. The reasons for that kind of structural setup historically are addressed within the model with regards to three of the entities, the institutions. They're built into the rules of the economy. One, balanced job complexes, jobs balanced for desirability and empowerment. Unions have fought for, at least some of the better ones, have fought for more greater empowerment among workers and greater desirability of the jobs that those workers have. And so that's already built into the economy. It's rule one, in fact. jobs are balanced for desirability and empowerment. That is part of the rule there already, part with the economy. What unions have fought for is already built into this model. So this would help, and actually one reason why a lot of unions, if they're ostensibly proposed for this, should, at least I think, use this as a part of a platform. Second rule, remuneration for effort and sacrifice. Same thing there. Historically, been fighting or going on strike for higher wages. I mean, for 5 years plus now, actually we're approaching six, the Congress workers strike in downtown Chicago. Workers have been, the hotel strike, thank you, have been fighting for remuneration for effort and sacrifice. We're wanting a new contract. And they've been at it for 5.5 years. Well, that's already built in, remuneration for effort and sacrifice. You get paid for, with the exceptions that we had described earlier regarding the handicap, the handicap situation, put it bluntly, but you get the idea. But if you get paid for work that you're doing that is in terms of effort and in terms of sacrifice, the more that you get put into that, you get paid back. So that's already built in as well, and that's something that I think unions should get beside because they're already on favor for this already. Self-managed worker and consumer decision-making bodies. Another historical reason for unions has been that workers have been have not had a whole lot of say in their in the circumstances in which they've had to work. Unions have gone a long way in terms of helping to change that to some extent. You could argue that there's been some little bit of rollback, but you can also find instances, the Republic worker strike being a classic one. People can organize to fight back. And so this is also built into the model, this historic need and concern that what I do, the work I do, I should have a say in. And also more to the point is the way that those decision-making bodies are organized. They're organized along what's called the self-management principle. The greater the say you have of that, the more decision-making power you have. So that if you have a decision that's you and you alone, you have unilateral dictatorial say over it. If it's you and five other people, you've got to figure out some way so that you can work together with those five other people regarding the decision and arrive at a way to agree on a decision for that. It could be 20 people, it could be however many. The model actually doesn't specify exactly how to handle that, but it actually does say as a universal rule, you got to use the self-management principle. And that kind of makes sense. The more say you have in a decision, the more impact the decision has on you, the more say you should have into that. How that handles with regards to conflicts or disagreements or where you've got people who are like 50-50, that's something to actually elaborate on in various models. But this is basically the rule of that. Now, you address the matter also with regards to corrupt unions. The hope would be that the institutions in play here would help to reduce that kind of corruption. I mean, and understandably so. I'll bet you that within this union of this particular example that you're finding, you probably have hierarchical decision-making power. Some relatively small group of people, maybe even one person, has a really empowering, really desirable job, and a lot of people within that union don't. So that's addressed with, well, item one, balanced job complexes. Remuneration for effort and sacrifice, same thing there. A lot of the people who are doing a lot of the heavy-duty work in what they're doing aren't getting paid a whole lot for doing it, whereas someone who isn't getting paid a whole lot for that is making out like a bandit. So same thing there. If you're going to be working in socially valued labor, if you're going to get paid for the effort and sacrifice, with some exceptions, of course. But that's the overall rule there. If there is a decision-making power where people have a say and a proportion to that impact, then hopefully that will help to mitigate that regarding a union or any entity that would do otherwise.
Those were some responses I gave at a panel on economics in Chicago on Saturday, April 25th, 2009. To learn more about the Albany Park, North Park, Mayfair Neighbors for Peace and Justice, go online to www.albanyparkforpeace.org. To learn more about participatory economics, go online to www.parecon.org. Parecon is spelled P-A-R-E-C-O-N. All past episodes of the Ministry of Truth are online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.